Well, welcome everybody to our next Nexus webinar. We're grateful to have Todd Bolsinger, the author of Canoeing the Mountains, with us. And we also have a couple co-hosts that are joining me this time around. I have Greg Garcia. He's our kind of head of coaching at Nexus, has been with us for, man, probably 12 plus years, 15 years or something like that. And Nexus planted a church down outside of Houston. And so he's with us. And we also have Patrick Lightfoot from Windsor, Colorado, planted a Traverse Christian Church about 5 years ago now, almost just celebrated 5 years, I think. So he's one of our coaches at Nexus. And so they're going to help us walk alongside just this conversation this morning. So I'm going to kick it over to Greg and we'll just get started from there.
All right. Hey, well, thanks, guys. And Todd, again, thanks for joining us on this webinar and interview process. So we just want to remind you maybe a little bit about the audience that's listening. We have guys that are planted churches 10 years ago. We've got guys that are just 2 weeks into their church plants. And we've got guys who just arrived in town and are fixing a plant here pretty soon. So we've got guys kind of all over the map. We've got guys that are in small towns, and we've got guys that are in big metropolitan areas. So we kind of run the gamut of all kinds of various possibilities in church planting. What we're doing right now is that Phil Claycomb and I, the director, we kind of came to a realization that we're going to have to get around to every region, meaning every state that we're planting in, which is about 20 some states, and just meet with all of our guys and start getting everybody ready for like a relaunch, a restart coming out of COVID. And we know and recognize that we are still very much in COVID. And if you can get past my political bias until the media tells us we're post-COVID, then we're not post-COVID. And so as we get ready for this transition to whatever post-COVID looks like, then maybe around the August, September timeframe, we're going to want all of our guys to be in a relaunch mode. Go back to basics, elementary church planting 101, and let's restart all of what needs to get done and get back to the business of reaching our communities. And also under the premise that, hey, church is different. And we're going to have to operate under the different premise of how church operates today. So in that relaunch tour that Phil and I have been taking, he selected a book and I selected a book. And so I selected Canoe in the Mountains. And so guys, those of you that are watching, if you have not received your book yet, you will probably receive a voucher soon to be able to download the book. So Canoe in the Mountains, been around for just a little bit. I remember hearing about it at a conference and I thought, man, I need to get that book. I've been privileged from Kentucky all the way to the Washington area to see almost all the various places that Lewis and Clark traversed. And it's been an absolute joy to read this book. So Todd, thanks again for joining us. What was the main premise for you to even write this book? Maybe you can just walk us through that as to why this was so important for you to even write.
Well, the biggest part about it was it started in my own experience of leading a church, doing well by almost every metric that we'd usually kind of traditionally think, you know, all of the numbers were going up and to the right, as they say. We had more people in church, we had more worship attendance, we had a stronger money. And then all of a sudden, one year, I ran into this weird thing where while the numbers were going in the right direction, the morale was going in the other direction. And I couldn't figure out what to do about it, because to me, they were linked. They had the sense that if things are going well, if the money and the attendance and the worship numbers are doing well, then why would the morale be going down? And what I discovered is, in a rapidly changing world, very often the numbers are a lagging indicator. They're not a leading indicator. You're still catching up. It's kind of like the conversation about COVID. We know that people who were infected 3 weeks ago are going to be getting sick today. And so it's hard to catch up, pay attention to numbers. And so what I discovered at that time was that the world was changing more rapidly than the way we were measuring it. And it meant that I was always playing catch up. And it meant that I was losing my best leaders, people who were already checking out. They were there was a kind of a common understanding that in a rapidly changing world, I needed to learn to lead differently. And I didn't know what that was. And that actually, that not knowing what it was became central to the way that you have to lead in a changing world, which is you don't lead as an expert that gets to bring your bag of tricks. You have to lead as a learner that has to learn as you go and be prepared to face loss. And those were two things I hadn't been prepared for in seminary. I hadn't been prepared for the notion that I would be learning as I go instead of learning everything and then going. And that I hadn't been prepared that along the way that growth and fruitfulness was going to be dependent upon loss and what you leave behind. And so those two things, learning and loss, I realized we're at the heart of a kind of leadership called adaptive leadership. And I began to become to study and practice adaptive leadership. And that's now been about 14 years of doing that with churches all over the country and in my own church and then at the seminary that I serve. So it's just been a long journey of learning to lead all over again.
Yeah. Well, I had written down 6 points that I wanted to cover with you today, and you kind of just touched on my number six. And one of the things that we teach our guys in the coaching process is that they have to be a constant student of their church and a constant student of their community. And now we have to be a constant student of the rapid change that COVID has brought on. Is it possible for the pastor to no longer understand the code of his church? So I forget what chapter it was, but you talked about the DNA factor, which we teach our guys about, but then you also brought up the idea of the code. And so is it possible for us as pastors to lose sight of our own DNA and our own code?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about that. So code is basically a way of talking about your deepest core values, the things that you're not going to change, the things that are essential to who you are. I think of them as your identity. So the question then is, can you lose track of your identity? And yeah, that happens all the time, right? That's exactly what happens is when we get overwhelmed by circumstances around us, we lose track of the most important things. And so, you know, one of the ways you just said that, which I really liked, is, you know, you've got to be a student of your church and of your context and of change. Well, I would say it all starts with being a student of yourself, that it starts in your own self-awareness, self-acknowledgement, the awareness of your mental models that you bring, the assumptions that you bring. The story is built on Lewis and Clark, who were two, you know, men of the Enlightenment, who were trained by Thomas Jefferson, who were participating in a project that was 300 years old that came out of Europe, that assumed that the most important thing in the world was to have a water route that would connect Europe to Asia, and that literally looked right past this entire continent called North America. You know, they believed they discovered it as if there was nobody there. They believed they had a right to dominate it as if there was nobody that would affect. And that even the water route that they were trying to find was a water route that assumed that Napoleon could sell it to Thomas Jefferson and that they could claim it. Just notice all the biases that are built from our past, that every single one of them actually had to be confronted for them to keep moving forward, including the assumption that it would be that the future would be discovered by a group of guys, a group of 28 men. And they didn't realize that what they actually needed was the voice of a teenage Native American nursing mother to become their guide in uncharted territory. And so a ton of the work we're doing today is just as disruptive and is just as need of that amount of humility, self-awareness, and learning that most of us who were trained in a world that assumed Christianity was in the center of culture just have not been trained for.
Yeah, it was interesting because we've talked about this a couple of times with our guys, but I'll bring this point back up one more time. 12 months ago, we used to joke and laugh at televangelists, and yet 12 months ago, we all became televangelists. And so, you know, for a lot of guys, they had to figure it out in a week. And there was guys, you know, plugging things together and trying to figure out if their cell phone could pull it off. And then, you know, the Facebook was crashing, and then some of the free sites were crashing, and because the volume was so heavy, and everyone was trying to figure out everything really overnight. And so I kind of liken that. Again, the reason why I picked this book is because I kind of liken that whole scene 12 months ago to what you called the mountain moment. It was the reality of the circumstance. And the river ends, which actually was the river began, and the source was the mountains that was in front of them. Can you maybe unpackage that whole thought process that you had behind that a little bit more for us?
Yeah. So the assumption, of course, of the Corps of Discovery was that they were going to be discovering a water route. They would go all the way up the Missouri River, all the way across what was then kind of the known west of the United States. They would find the Columbia River on the other side. They would connect to the Columbia River. And then by claiming that water route that would go from the Pacific Ocean all the way to the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico, they would then have the water route. And that's, of course, the assumption was that was an economic advantage, right? It would be like owning the internet today. Like, it would be like you have the ability to control trade from Europe to Asia. What they found is after 18 months of paddling upstream, they walked up to the top of the Lemhi Pass and they found the Rocky Mountains. Now, the weird part about this, of course, is they were told by the Mandan tribe, you know, the people who were there, there are mountains. And they said, big deal. We're good at mountains. We're from Virginia. We have the Shenandoah Mountains. And what they had is no mental model of what people meant by a mountain. They had a model built on the past. Rounded hills, 3,000-4,000 feet tall, not jagged peaks, 14,000 feet, that would go 300 miles, that no water route, no river could run through. So now they went from being canoers, and they had to decide, are we about water navigation or are we about discovery? And once they decided that they were going to keep going, they had to drop the canoes. And that's, in one sense, you think, well, big deal. They got rid of some equipment. No, huge deal. They changed their identity. They were no longer water navigators who were expert water runners. They were now people carrying the luggage. They now had to walk and they had to explore. And they were completely off the map. Nobody from European descent had ever been there. Nobody knew what that looked like. When the Mandan tribe told them that there would be mountains, they said, oh, no big deal. And then they realized they had no idea what they were talking about. And even though they had seen the mountains for 3 months, I mean, a couple of you guys live in Colorado, you know that on a clear day, you can see the Rocky Mountains from Kansas, right? Even though they'd seen the Rocky Mountains for 3 months, they lived in denial about how much change was coming in front of them. And what they had to realize is they actually had to not only drop the canoes, they had to drop a bunch of their pretenses and a bunch of their biases, and they had to learn to learn as they go in order to keep navigating forward. And that's the place that we're in. We were in this, I would say, I wrote Canoeing in the Mountains in 2013. It came out in 2015, and it was being used by churches. I traveled 100,000 miles around the world speaking on it. And up until the pandemic isn't our problem. The pandemic just made real what's been happening in the church for a generation, which is that we are moving from the center of culture to the margins of culture, which for some of us is terrible. We got to get back to the center of culture, except in the scriptures, there's no assumption that the people of God will ever be the center of culture. They will be a witness to all people. And so the notion that we are literally about being a witnessing missional communities in whatever culture we're in, this moment of disruption actually allows us to recover our birthright and to move into the future as learners. You know, that's learner and disciple. That's the same word, like learners who are leading to going through loss and are navigating change as you go.
Yeah. Patrick, I think you did some training with your team based on this book. So what
you want? Yeah, actually, I want to follow up kind of what where we're at on this. Todd, thank you for being with us and sharing this book with us. Our staff went through it last year before a staff retreat last August, and it was very, very helpful in the time. And you shared a story from 2008 when you and your family went to Alaska, and John and Karen, and basically moving completely off grid, and they've got three teenagers, and there's no electricity, no cell phones, no toilets. They've got to walk 2 miles to the bus route. Like, talk about how to teach someone how to be adaptive. And one of the questions that was asked is this, and John said this, he says, if you have someone to show you a few tricks, you can adapt to anything. And so what are a few tricks you might have in the area of adaptation, being flexible for church leaders as we find ourselves kind of coming out of this post-COVID season or moving towards a more post-COVID season?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that question. Not many people ask about that chapter, and that was actually pretty dear to me. You know, so a couple of tricks are this. One of the things to recover is this notion that I've said it a lot, this notion of being a learner. Like one of the tricks you have to actually recover is the belief that your leadership is not built on your expertise. Like we all think, I mean, we live in this world, you know, the expert becomes the leader. The problem is expert doesn't necessarily translate to leader, right? Best preacher doesn't mean best leader or best pastor, right? Best salesperson doesn't mean best sales manager. You know, best scholar doesn't mean best dean of the faculty. Like there's a lot of difference. And so one of the things you actually need is to have someone teach you to really become comfortable with learning as you go. And one of the things I liked about John in Alaska is the guy had been lived in Alaska forever. And every day he was coming back with, here's a new thing I learned. I was out with some of the Native American folks. I was on a trip. I came, he was just always in the process of learning as you go. And so I would say your superpower, if I can use that phrase, is to actually be a disciple, to be a person who's continually humbly learning as you go, experimenting as you go, being willing to fail quickly and learn from that failure, even if need be, and then adapt. And so, yeah, a whole bunch of churches all discovered, you know, how to use technology. The goal isn't to be the best church with technology. The goal is to actually think about how we can leverage technology to further our mission. But it's going to probably be some hybrid version. It's going to be high tech and high touch. You know, when the pandemic is finally over, I'm not going to keep doing Zoom calls with my kids. I'm going to fly, get on planes and hug their necks. Like I want to be with them deeply, but I'm probably also going to spend more time on Zoom calls with people who can't afford me to fly places. So, I mean, last year I did 30 trips in 2019. I did 30 trips in 52 weeks. In 2020, all those trips were canceled and I've done over 105 webinars. So the question going forward is going to be, what is the combination of what you learn and what you leave behind, what you take with you, and what you're able to kind of adapt that is going to help you to move forward? And that process of continually learning is going to be really important. I'll just give you just two quick things, two tips I've learned. One is, watch your bias about the idea of returning. I can't wait till we get back to church. We get back to this. We get back to that. I just want to say this bluntly. I don't think any of us want to go back to the church that's losing a million millennials a year, which is what we were doing before COVID. So let's instead think about how we can move forward and learn from this. What's been revealed? What's become important to us? Well, how can we learn everything we possibly can as we go forward? That's one thing. It's watching our bias about wanting to go back. And the other one is watching our bias about the way we talk about the church being closed. I'm church planters. You probably don't use this as much as people in traditional churches, but you know, literally, if you go on Google and you look up most churches, it says the church is closed. And as long as you think the church is about the building, it's going to be open or closed based on buildings. And I think buildings are going to become more and more like church buses. Some people are going to have buildings and some people are not. Some people are going to have buses. Some churches used to have buses. Some don't anymore. It's really not about busing. It's about getting people where we need them to be. I think it's not going to be about buildings. It's going to be about gathering people for the work of the ministry. And so if we can start thinking about which of the tools and stuff we use that we built our identity around that we need to be able to lay down, we're going to find ourselves much more agile along the way.
Yeah. So some of the things that we're reviewing in our tour is, you know, in the relaunch, it's time to change our approach, trying to regather what we've been doing, time to kill a lot of things. This is a perfect time to kill a lot of things that we've been doing that maybe just didn't work, or it's the perfect excuse to be able to start new. I was struck by something else though, in your book. And I, you know, I write a lot of notes in my margins of books, and I wrote in one part, it says like a greater sense of call. And it was kind of at that moment where, I mean, all of this is somewhat conjecture, right? But like, I think the guys could have gone back east when they hit the Rocky Mountains, and I don't think anybody would have said anything different. Like, great try, guys. Man, you gave it your best shot. I think they probably still would have been seen as heroes that they went as far as they did. But to change from canoes to horses and keep going, I think there's this greater sense of call. So I don't know what you see in the church in your circles, but do you see a difference between guys that are going to dig down deep and guys that are just going to say, hey, I'm out? Because there's some other work that was done by George Barna and some other researchers that said 1 in 5 churches may not survive. So like, can you describe maybe what you see in your circles as what's the difference between the guys that dig down deep and say, hey, we're going forward. We're not going to turn back, like that point of no return. Can you, are you tracking with me? Can you maybe?
No, actually the metaphor you said, Greg, is actually really accurate. They were supposed to find a water route. They had the economic survival of this young United States of America was built on finding the water route. You can actually argue that they should have gone back. They should have gone back and told Jefferson, look, there isn't a water route, change your economic model, but they didn't. And the reason why they didn't is because Meriwether Lewis had been tutored by Thomas Jefferson, and his deepest value was an enlightenment value. It's not necessarily a Christian value, but it was a value. And the value is this: it was the deep belief that the growth of human knowledge would lead to the growth of human happiness. That was his value. So we can ask ourselves, what's our deepest value? And if our deepest value is how many people we can get into pews, how many people we can get giving us money in the offering plate, how much power and influence we can have in the culture, we're going to be in trouble. We should probably go back and say those values aren't going to work. Instead, we got to go to our deepest value, which is, what does it mean for us to be people who love God and love our neighbor, who are a witness to the reign of God, who literally are supposed to be the people who are the answer to Jesus's prayer, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth. And when you start thinking about these deeper values, it starts letting you let go of everything that has, some of them have brought you safely this far, right? They've gotten you to this point, but you now have to let them go. I'll just give you 2 examples of things that I think are gonna be radically disruptive in most churches. One of them is even revealed to by looking at this picture and the way we talk. We assume leaders are men. We said guys a million times. And the future of the church is going to be in teams of groups that have to be men and women together that look just like the first church, Priscilla and Aquila, right? You're going to have more and more a diversity of voices. You're going to have people who are experts and people who are experienced. Experts in the world we're going into, experience and wisdom. You're going to need young and old, just like the prophecy of Joel. You're going to need everybody to be the body of Christ together, which means we're going to need more collaborative forms of ministry, more teams. And this is a place where the church planting movement can help the traditional church movement. Because in the traditional church, there's a clear org chart and there's someone in charge and it's usually a guy and it's got a clear hierarchy. And almost every church planting movement I know, it's about getting the best group of people together to function much more like a missionary team. And Lewis and Clark show us that. They are literally Lewis and Clark. They're known as one name, even though they were two people who defied Congress's order to have a military chain of command, because what they needed in the wilderness was a partnership. Well, the Congress told them, no, Lewis is in charge, Clark is number 2. And they said, no, we're gonna be co-equals, partners in every way. And then they get over the Rocky Mountains and get to face the Rocky Mountains, and they get Sacagawea, who is literally a marginalized person, and they need every bit of her leadership, so much so that William Clark says she's the pilot who took them through the wilderness. And she's the one who connects them to the Shoshone, and the Shoshone add even more people to their party to help them get through. So overcoming the things of the past that got us here, that are just kind of these built-in assumptions, by going to the deeper value of what it means to be people of the gospel, who look more like the early church, who are more about being witnesses in much more creative ways going forward, is going to give us a chance to move forward.
Hey, Greg, can I step in? I got a question, because I highlighted that story. That's one of my favorite stories of that. And also, they had a slave named York, and it was the first slave and the first woman to get a vote as they were doing some voting on kind of some next steps in their adventure. And so my question, Todd, for you is, how do we value people and the decision-making process. I know the church has had its ways with guys, men, as you see four guys here on this call. How do we take those next steps in bringing on people of different color, different gender, into making, basically modeling what was modeled by Lewis and Clark? Because as you said, they would have been stuck there at the end of the river. They couldn't have made it without her. Obviously, I mean, what an amazing story of this woman who was nursing a child, but leading at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's a very empowering story. So what are some next steps maybe for us as the church in moving in that direction?
Well, I appreciate you raising it, Patrick, and asking the question. And let me say this really clearly. The story of Lewis and Clark is fraught. It's a troubling story to me. It's like the Bible stories. I often say, you know, one of the best principles I learned about interpreting the Bible is the Bible doesn't give us models to emulate, except for Jesus. It gives us mirrors we identify with. So we see all kinds of things in the scriptures that we know not to emulate. You know, you don't talk about David being a man after God's own heart and then saying, oh, by the way, if you get a chance to get the young girl and kill her husband, take advantage of it. Never, right? Never. The problem with Lewis and Clark is you have people who literally were men of their era, who basically had the attendant biases of their era, who had to disrupt them to keep going, who had to rethink them. So yeah, on the trip, York, who is an African-American slave, actually gets treated on the trip like he is like every other person. He gets treated with more and more respect as they go. And you pointed out that when they get to finally to Oregon and they do a vote on where to put the fort, where the United States of America would be in the New World, York and Sacagawea both get a vote. First 100 years before African-Americans or women or Native Americans would have votes, they get a vote, right? What happens, however, is as soon as they went back into the old world, they reverted to their old world thinking. So York becomes a slave again. And William Clark says, I had to beat him because he became so arrogant because he went on this core of discovery. He thinks he's somebody now, right? It's this daunting, sobering moment for us. And I always say, this is one of the reasons to remember that when we are the church on mission, we tend to be at our very best. When we settle and what we want is security in our culture and in our society, we tend to reflect the worst values of our culture and our society. And this is a sobering moment for many of us who are church leaders, is to realize that when we are being creative, depend upon the Lord, open to the Spirit, we see scripture passages and we see we hear the voices of the people in front of us and we start realizing, oh my gosh, we are better when we look more like Revelation 5 from every tribe and tongue and nation. We are better when we believe that the Holy Spirit is poured out on the young men and women, on our sons and daughters. We are better when we recognize that the global church right now is doing better than the Western church. Here's like the most disruptive thing I ever said. And it's just true. It's based on the reason why the United States, which is shrinking in religious conformity, right? Last week, just this week, there was a new study that said that less than half of Americans are attending a church, a synagogue, or a temple. Like, we're now below 50% say they're a member of that. First time in our history. We're still way ahead of Europe. The number one reason sociologists say we're still ahead of Europe in our religiosity is immigration. Christians come to this country. Catholics, Pentecostals, Syrian Christians, and when they come, they bring their deep faith. I work at a school that has students from all over the world. And many of them are being part of movements that have come to the United States to be able to live out the gospel in the United States. We start realizing these are things that are going to disrupt our mental models unless we continue to think like church planters and missionaries and folks who are moving forward into uncharted territory, learning as we go, letting go of the things of the past that hold us, experimenting our way forward, wrestling with our deepest values that we should never change.
Yeah, I read the same report, and I think they said it was 47%.
Yeah,
claim to be a church member somewhere. You also in your book, you talk about the moment when they split up for about a 6-week time frame, but they split up for the purpose of learning.
Yeah.
And look at my notes here. One of the things we've been also challenging our guys with is, again, this whole learning process. This is what I'm glad you keep bringing this thing up, but you know, we're like, what have we learned? And what have we learned about ourselves in the last 12 months? So what have we learned about our church? What have we learned about God? What have we learned about us and God? You personally, you the pastor and God, what have you learned about yourself in the last 12 months? Now you're telling us that we should be thinking about teams and groups and men and women and the experts and the expertise. Would you say that there's maybe two other things that we should have learned or should be learning right now from in light of the last 12 months? Are there two more things we should be learning?
Two more. Well, one, I think, one of the most important things we can do is to think about the fact that we're going to experiment our way forward. We need to experiment our way forward. I spent a lot of my time because of the work I do at the seminary with some folks in Silicon Valley, all the innovative types. And they have this phrase they talk a lot about, which is that you don't try to predict the future. You prototype your way to the future. Prototypes are small, modest experiments. You know, sometimes you'll hear them say stuff like, you know, fail fast. I had a venture capitalist look at me and say, well, fail cheap. It's my money, right? So learning how to fail fast and fail cheap. Well, what's the key to failing fast and failing cheap? It's to change the question. The question isn't, did it work? The question is, so what did we learn? So what have we learned after a year of doing technology and Zoom courses? What did we learn? What did we learn about streaming? What did we learn about the people who sometimes check us out and sometimes check out? What did we learn about the difference between worship attendance, which has been the leading indicator, and membership, where people actually make a commitment to one another? What do we learn about some of our old traditional ways of thinking about things that actually might be more enduring? What have we learned about, one person put it this way, which is, I think we're going to live in a world where there's going to be a lot less handshakes and a lot more hugs. You're going to decide who you're closer to, and you're going to want to be with those people because the deep relationships matter more than ever. They got you through this, and you're going to be really okay with having less people who are tangentially connected to you. So the question, you know, one of the things we're learning is this sounds weird, but we have to learn how to keep learning and really ask ourselves questions about those things as we go forward. We've got to be willing to prototype our way forward. And that's going to feel hard. And so in the 1990s, they used to always say, you know, skate to where the puck is going. You know, that was the Wayne Gretzky phrase. My answer today is there's four pucks going in four different directions. So I don't know where you're going to skate. But what you need to do is probably keep skating and looking and skating and looking and skating and looking, right? And so don't predict prototype is one of the key learnings, I think, of this time.
All right, thank you. Patrick, what else did you want to ask?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to mission. You talked about that. In one of your chapters, it's called Mission Trumps. And I just want to read one of the quotes. It's one that resonated with me, is that leadership is taking people where they need to go, yet resist going. And I think for a leader, that's one of the most frustrating things, is like you feel like you're dragging these people all the time. Yeah. And as I read through the book and the story of Lewis and Clark, it didn't seem like they were dragging many people with them. It seemed like they were excited about it. So you go on to define leadership as this: it's energizing a community of people toward their own transformation in order to accomplish a shared mission in the face of a changing world. And so to me, it seems like two things: this energizing people and on mission. Can you talk to that for us? It seems we know as church leaders, the mission is to make disciples who make disciples who make disciples. And I guess my question is, how do we convey as people are making disciples that they are going to grow themselves? Mm-hmm. I feel like that's the hurdle of energizing them in their own walk with the Lord and being on mission. If they're doing the mission, this is going to happen too. And so can you kind of speak into that just for a few moments?
Yeah. So the question that everybody wanted to talk about, no matter where I went, was the pet chapter actually on sabotage, which is the idea of the resistance. Leadership is about having to deal with resistance, your own people's resistance. The big discovery of COVID wasn't, oh my gosh, there's a pandemic, how are we going to adapt? It's actually been, for most people, it's been, oh, there's been a pandemic, we've tried to adapt, and the most resistant people are our own people. they're so busy fighting over whether we should gather in person or wear masks or not. They forget that there's the neighbors next door who are probably lonely and in need of a touch of grace and need of friendship. Like we have so, the most soul-sucking thing for most leaders isn't the challenges around us. It's not looking at mountains. It is the morale within the core. And what Lewis and Clark did actually have to confront is sabotage from their own people. Some folks who just said, we're tired, we don't want to go forward. And they had to deal with it. And that's the part that the most recent book I wrote, which is a book on resilience, is really about the resilience needed to overcome the internal resistance of our own people. And you see this right there in the story of the Exodus, right? 6 weeks after the parting of the Red Sea, the greatest miracle you'd have until the resurrection. 6 weeks later, a group of former slaves are saying, you know, slavery, they killed our children, but we had leeks and onions for lunch. Maybe we should think about going back. And what you end up with is a whole bunch of folks who talk about wanting to make disciples who make disciples. And then what they actually want is you to have a church that serves their spiritual need, takes care of their children, makes sure that the programs are such that they don't have to have any fights on Sunday morning to get kids to church. Like you start realizing that all of a sudden it becomes very different than what you expected it to be. And that is one of the most soul-sucking things. And so the most recent book I wrote is really about how do we develop the resilience to continue to lead change, especially when we're dealing with our own people's internal resistance.
In a few minutes, we want to be able to give the viewers a chance to ask some questions. So guys, start formulating your questions now. I want to get back. So from your perspective right now, Todd, at Fuller Theological Seminary, what are some of the things that you're seeing across the nation? Let me put it this way. Is there a denomination, maybe, or
I think we lose him. Lost the end of your question right there, Greg. I think we lost your audio. Once you, there you go.
All right, I'll try that again. from Fuller Theological Seminary, are you guys seeing any either denomination or any group that seems to be trekking the mountain well right now in the last 12 months?
Yeah. So one of the best parts, so my work at Fuller, I went for, after 27 years of being in the church as a pastor, I went to Fuller to basically help them transition the idea of theological education for a changing world. And what we really are discovering is the places where there is the most amount of vibrancy are places where theological education is partnered with on-site mission training. Like people are, instead of thinking about you get a master's degree and then you start doing ministry, it's you start doing ministry and you learn as you go. And we're seeing that really in the denominations that have been in some ways less traditional, that are being much more innovative. And you see these places, and especially the most interesting places are like the Latino church, the African-American church, the immigrant church, the global church. Like when you start having those churches speak to you about biases in education, I would say if the church is resistant to change because our models of church are like 100, 150 years old, education models are 1100 years old. And they started in monasteries. And so the idea that we're going to actually change the way we think about leadership formation. So that's become my work. It's moved more and more into the notion of how do you form leaders for a rapidly changing world? And today I lead the Church Leadership Institute. I left my role as a senior administrator after helping them work through a change process so that I could give myself 100% to this question. How do you form church leaders into change leaders, faithful change leaders? And the answer to that is it's really about learning from each other on the way in this kind of adaptive mode that is really, really important. I mean, you just have to remember, everybody who comes to seminary, somebody said to them, you're the best Christian I know, you should go pro. You should go off to professional Christian school and then you can do this for a living. It'll be awesome. And they come to our campuses and we give them a degree and we send them with a master of divinity. It's like they're a superhero. And then some church some picks them up and puts them in the church and says, you're the answer. Like, you, look at you, you're the answer. And what they have to do literally is start giving that work back to that community. I'm not the answer. The Spirit of God that is at work in us is the answer. And we have to all be transformed together. And the words of Ronald Heifetz from Harvard, it means that we are disappointing people at a rate they can absorb. And that leadership is really about disappointing people. It's about taking people through the learning, through the loss, through the transformation, so that we can continue to grow. And that's a lifetime pursuit and not a something that you get mastered and then you're done with it.
Yeah, there's another great book out there right now called Think Like a Rocket Scientist. And part of the premise of that book is, he says, test as you fly and fly as you test. And so the idea there is, you know, you can design rockets all day long. At some point in time, you can launch it. And so we are in a world of church planting. Everybody that's watching is in church planting. And there gets to be a point in time where you just got to pull the trigger. And you just got to get the thing off the ground. You got to get it launched. And then you're going to start learning all kinds of things as you go. So that's a great word for me right there. I appreciate that. So Patrick, was there something else you wanted to cover today as well?
Yeah, my final question was based on the very last chapter in the epilogue, talk about taking the hill with grandma. So I really like that. And I guess my question for you is, we don't get to pick our church. God brings people through our doors that we have been called to pastor, minister, love, and care, teach and train and equip. And so I love what you said here about the pastors, that we have to be professional and personal. We're expected to know everything about the mystery of God and everyone's name and our congregation. And then we're expected to, translate scripture and perfectly understand and oversee our finances. So we have to wear all these hats, do all these things. The expectations are high. And then we have this team of people that we didn't get to handpick, but it's been given to us by God. I guess the question, or what words of encouragement could you give to any church leader, whether it's an existing church for 100 years or it's a church planner who's getting ready to launch in a month, knowing that the expectation of the bar is high in the eyes of people for us. And yet we have, I would say, a group of knuckleheads. That's what I always call the disciples. Mm-hmm. Jesus picked the least of these. And I got to hear the good news and the hope of Christ because of 12 faithful, obedient guys. So what words would you just share kind of as we kind of wrap this up before the Q&A for church leaders to encourage them in these next steps?
Yeah, thank you for asking. In my book, Tempered Resilience, I worked on the whole notion of how do you form people to be resilient. And what I started with is the raw material of a change leader, of a genuine transformational leader, is actually an unexpected raw material. It's like, it's great steel that then has to then go through a transformation. But the raw material is actually interesting. In order to be successful at leading change, starting a new thing, starting a new model of ministry, you have to be grounded in something other than your success. You have to have yourself grounded in something other than your success at leading change. If your identity is attached to your success, oh, I'm going to be a successful church planter. I'm going to be the senior pastor. I'm going to start a movement. If your identity is, you will not make it. Your identity has to be grounded in something other. And the place where we see this is actually in the life of Jesus, right? Before Jesus preaches a sermon, does a miracle, changes water to wine, casts out a demon, confronts a power, before he does anything, the first thing is he hears a voice that says to him, you are my beloved, and in you I'm well pleased. God's already pleased. So what I would want all the church planners to know is the most important thing, especially this, we're taping this in Holy Week, right? The most important thing to remember in Holy Week is that your life and God's love for you is more important than what you accomplish for God. Your willingness to be faithful to God must come out of a deep rootedness in knowing you are already loved. Eugene Peterson translates that passage of, you are the pride of my life, God's Spirit says to Jesus. Can you know that you are the pride of God's life, that you are beloved, that you are absolutely well held, you are already approved? Now you can lay yourself down, you can learn, you can be humble, you can become adaptable, you can then become more resilient. And that's the work we do. That's the work we do at the Church Leadership Institute. It's the work that you guys are doing. I'm so glad to support a group that wants to coach people through it, because I think coaching is critical to the work. And I think it becomes more and more important for us to be able to be grounded in something. You need a deep, grounded spiritual life as well as the capacity to lead. And that's the work that we do together.
So Andrew, is there any questions that are out there?
Not currently, no. I like, Todd, that you kind of went into just the tempered resilience thing. Are there any other like key insights? So obviously, Todd, for those joining us, author of Canoeing the Mountains, that was several years ago, I think 2012, 2013. Is that what you said, Todd?
It came out in 2015. Yeah.
2015. Okay. Yeah. And then just recently, the tempered resilience thing of just leaders mm-hmm. are formed in the crucible of change. Just some of those type of things. Are there things that... that maybe you're writing about or thinking yeah. about, or other leaders are asking about, the just yeah. questions that we're not asking right now?
Yeah, well, thank you. I think the fact that, that you're even spending time connecting and listening to the people that you work with, the leaders you work with, is really critical. Let me just do two things. Number one, let me just tell anybody who wants to get more information about stuff, they can do a really simple thing. They can just text the word change, change to 66866. That's too many sixes in a row for a pastor, but that's the number they gave me. Change 66866. And the reason why I give you that is because I've got people on my team who have made it really, really simple to get connected and get resources. A bunch of them are free that you can just get and you can use. Because one of the things we learned about leading change is that it's more about your own continual willingness to change and change faithfully, to figure out what you're not going to change. And how that, for most of us, we want that to be a very big, big, big set of things. And it's usually a very important core set of things. And that how you need to have the resilience to figure out how to adapt. The metaphor that I use in the book this time is the metaphor of Dr. Martin Luther King's speech, the famous I Have a Dream speech, where he literally, you know, the I Have a Dream section wasn't in the original speech. He extemporaneously adds it. Because a gospel singer, Mahalia Jackson, yells at him, tell him about the dream, Martin, tell him about the dream. And he slides the notes off to the side and he starts launching into Isaiah 40. And one of his speechwriters who was with him, like who was standing sitting beside him, says to the person next to him, these people don't know, but they're about to go to church. And 250,000 people all heard an exposition of Isaiah 40 about how God is going to change the all of creation. And then he says, with this faith, we go back to the South. Think about that phrase. With this faith, we go back to the South. What did that mean? Back to the marches, the protests, the jails, the dogs, the hoses. With this faith, we go back to the work. With this faith, we'll be able to hew out of a mountain of despair stones of hope. And for me, that is the work of the gospel. It is hewing out of a mountain of despair stones of hope. That's the work of leadership. It is... No, so when I hear the phrase stones of hope, I think 1 Peter, right? Come to him a living stone and let yourself as living stones be built into a dwelling place for God. Oh my gosh. How can we take these things that are despairing us and chisel, transform them? What do you do with a mountain of despair? You don't bash it with a sledgehammer. You don't blow it up with dynamite, and you don't back down. You hew it. You transform it into a stone of hope. And I look at every leader as becoming the chisel that God uses to bring hope out of despair, right at the places where there's despair in the world. And that chisel, to do that, it has to be a tempered tool, a tool that is both strong and flexible. And that's the idea of a resilient leader. And that's a process that we have to go through. That's a process that we quote, that we coach people through. It's processes that we lead people through. We've got cohorts of people being trained in. It's the kind of process that you all are making available to your church leaders by just connecting with them and caring for them and supporting them and challenging them. It's this process of formation to become resilient, tempered tools who can hew hope from despair.
Yeah. So Tom, one of the things that we also teach our guys is that for every increment of growth of 50, they should be changing. And their leadership should be changing. What they do should be changing. Who they trust other parts of leadership to should be changing. So the leader has to constantly change for every increment of growth of 50. One of the things I was fascinated about with the whole Lewis and Clark story is that there was also constant change. And again, not to keep beating this thing up, but that, like, again, they could have gone back. They didn't have to separate for 6 weeks for the purpose of learning. When a baby comes along, that was more change. Things that a group of guys are not necessarily going to be accustomed to out in the wilderness. Now, man, we got to drag around the baby. What are some of the hurdles that guys stumble on by not allowing themselves to change? Does that
So that valid question? One of the quotes that I've used for years that I continue to use is from Eric Hoffer. He says, "The learners inherit the earth. The learned find themselves beautifully equipped for a world that no longer exists." And I think what happens, what we stumble on, is the more experienced we get, the further up we get, the more we become, the more senior we get in the organization, the more people look at us, quote us, listen to us, let us coach them, the more tempting it is for us to become the learned who are beautifully equipped for a world that no longer exists. William Clark had been an experienced military leader. In order to go on the Corps of Discovery, he literally had to become a partner with the person who used to be his subordinate. And then together, they had to let other voices and other people be experts who worked with them. They had to learn as they go. It just takes an amazing amount of humility that most of us have just not been cultivated to develop. I mean, we talk about it a lot, but you don't see it much in the church these days. You see people heading onto platforms, heading into pinnacles, and then falling or blowing up. So to be committed to a lifetime of your own formation becomes critical, or you're going to be equipped only for the past. And this is really hard. I mean, this is profoundly painful for many of us, especially, you know, I'm 57. I was privileged 30 years ago. I got a full ride scholarship from my church to go to seminary. The reason why people who look like me are at the top of most org charts today is because 30 years ago, we were privileged. And now today we realize that's creating a problem in the church, that there's not enough leaders, there's not enough diversity, there's not enough people who are getting opportunities to learn and to be part of leadership teams. So anything you can do, I always say, to be a learning community that increases the diversity of voices, that does modest experiments and then resiliently faces resistance together, is going to be able to exist, going to do better in a changing world.
I appreciate that. We only have just a few minutes left. So Andrew, do you need to, any questions, or do you need to close us out? And I'll let you just close us out.
Yeah, no, no more questions. Patrick, let me, any last comments, questions from you?
No, I just want to say thank you. One of the quotes from the book that resonated with our team is the one that's start with conviction, stay calm, stay connected, and stay the course. And so we're really trying to figure out how to make disciples who make disciples, and that's the mission. And so we actually made a dog tag that I gave our staff for our retreat. So anyway, this is something we try to just remember often, because you know how easy and short memories people have, leaders have, churches have. And so we just want to keep memorizing that and keep that at our focal point. So I'm just grateful for the book. It meant a lot to me and our team, and I appreciate you carving out a few moments for us today, Todd. Really do.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It's been nice to be with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Todd, thank you so much for joining us. Oh, go ahead, Greg.
I was just simply going to say yes. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. Greatly appreciate it.
Okay, good. Thanks, guys. Appreciate your time.